need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I'm an editor at TheRinger.com. And today on the show, Sam Esmail makes his triumphant return to The Watch with me and Andy Greenwald and Kai McMullen on this episode as we talk about our favorite TV shows of the year. It's one of my favorite episodes to do every year. Sam has been so gracious with his time coming to tell us about how we are wrong about TV every year. So let's get right into it. Sam Esmail on the best shows of the year. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
It's a tradition unlike any other. It's the return of Sam Esmail, one of the Big Picture's best guests, to his home on the Ringer Podcast Network.
Aww, this is so sweet.
The Watch Podcast. It's our annual best of television podcast that we do with Sam. We've done it four years now. How many years in a row have we done this?
I don't remember.
Four?
Yeah. That feels right.
Sam, it's Andy, it's Kaya, it's Chris. We're going to do it a little bit differently this year because I think in the previous years, what's happened is we've done this very expansive, like kind of state of television conversation at the beginning, and that goes on for a while. And then we do a very long, like, well, my number 10 was this, and that's actually my number 7, and that's actually my number 3, and we go back and forth. I think that there's a lot of overlap in all of our lists this year. So what we're going to do is we're going to have this conversation about the state of television. We have a bunch of topics we want to hit, and within those topics, we're going to talk about a lot of the shows that are on all of our lists. And then at the very end of the pod, we'll just list off our shows, but we are obviously going to be posting on our Twitter accounts and on the Facebook account and everywhere else our lists. So you can just refer to them throughout the show. You can know where we're coming from. So anyway, hello to Andy and Kaya. I see you all the time, but Sam, welcome. Welcome back to where you belong.
Thank you guys. Thank you. That was such a warm welcome. How are you guys doing?
We're really happy to see you, Sam, because much like HBO Max, you have been pulled from the big screen to where we feel you work best, the tiny Zoom windows with us. I think that's the right way to begin a conversation about the year in television.
That is such a beautiful metaphor. Hey, by the way, let me just start off by saying, and I think I texted you this a couple of times throughout the year, great fucking year for TV. Great fucking year. I've complained about the state of TV for the past couple of seasons, past couple of years, but I thought this year was tough. It was tough to get top 10. I have a bunch of honorable mentions. I don't know if we'll have time to get to that, but it was really tough to squeeze it in. And honestly, there's still shows coming out. I keep reading about Nicholas Winding Refn's Maniac Cop series. I'm excited to see that. I don't know if that's coming out in 2020, but for as shit of a year it has been, I think TV really, it transcended in a lot of ways. And we're going to talk about it because there's some shows on my list that some people are going to call movies and, you know, some people are going to call sandwiches and we're going to have that conversation. But also, given what is going on with movies, going on the streamers, it's like the lines have never been blurred. And I personally, I know there's a lot of critics out there about what's going on with HBO Max, including your friends, Sean and Amanda.
Haters and losers.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's great. I think it's silly when I keep reading on social that I don't want to see Dune on my couch. Great. Go fucking see it in the theater if you think it's safe enough to go see it in the theater. No one's telling you not to see it in the theater. This is just another option for people to see it. And the whole kind of hysteria over the death of movie theaters. To me, this is like, I welcome movie theaters need to earn my money better than this dumb theatrical window exclusivity thing that is honestly just has never been a compelling argument to get people to force them into the theaters, especially with all the options they have now at home. So anyway, I can go on a rant about this. I know we're talking about TV, but my point is the lines have never been more blurred between the two. I had this conversation about Bad Education. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Yeah,
the Hugh Jackman movie. No.
Fucking great that movie, but it's a TV movie at the Emmys. Is it not going to be at the Oscars, even though the Oscars are taking in, you know, films that premiere on streamers? This is the interesting question that I think we're going to tackle from now on. And I personally find that great. I find it great that we can finally be sort of platform agnostic when we talk about great storytelling like this. So.
Well, I'm interested in hearing you take that tack, Sam, because I think that a lot of people may have interpreted your career and your opinions as being slightly different, which is to say you brought a lot of cinema to the small screen in how you approached, how you broke, how certainly how you shot Mr. Robot and Homecoming. And I think one takeaway from that, and apparently incorrect one, was that forget TV, you're going to bring movies to TV. But what you're suggesting is that it's all going in through the same tubes and on the same box. They should all just be elevated, right? Like the quality is the quality, and you're not, you're increasingly, you're not distinguishing between the two.
Absolutely not. I'm going to talk about this in one of my picks, but to say that TV is a writer's medium now, to be honest with you, I've always found that argument a little bogus. It's never been a writer's medium. It's a filmmaking medium. And that doesn't mean that's a director's medium. It's a writer is a filmmaker, a director is a filmmaker, a costume designer is a filmmaker, the performers are a filmmaker. You got to use all the tools at your disposal. This is a visual medium, and you're trying to use every inch of that frame to tell your story. And so back in the day, maybe it was just documenting dialogue that was written on the page and that's it. No dollies, no movement, no stylistic shots or anything like that. But those days are gone. And now we're actually using, you know, and to even call it TV is a little odd, right? You know, is Netflix TV? I mean, just because it outputs on the TV, I don't know anymore. But for me, it's just, I feel like we don't need to have that debate between TV and movies anymore. That's what's exciting to me. It doesn't matter. It's we're watching great storytelling, and whether it's an and we're going to debate this too, right? Because whether it's an episodic storytelling format like a TV series or like a Marvel fucking cinematic universe, or whether it's a self-contained movie with chapters like a Tarantino film, or if it's like small acts where it's an anthology of films and some of them are 2 hours and some of them an hour. I mean, for me, the lines being blurred are honestly the best thing for the industry, because I think we're going to, the definitions are going to lose value. And I've always hated the labels anyway. So ultimately, I think we're just going in a great direction. Personally.
I hope that this is your announcement that you're going to Kevin Feige and you're pitching the MCFU, the Marvel Cinematic fucking Universe. And it's, well, it's just like all the other Marvel stuff, except people say fucking all the time.
Well, look, I mean, let's, you know, if you want to have that conversation.
It's fucking Thanos!
So, Sam, going back to the first thing you said, which was heartening to hear, because I think we all agree, this was unquestionably an awful year on Earth, but TV was really good. And I think
they were
Chris
killing
and I were
it
both
on the moon, though. It was great. They had From Earth
mankind
to the Moon. You know?
Season 3 renewal. I think Chris and I were curious if your own experience living through this year played a part in your affection for the TV that you saw. Do you think that you were watching TV differently? Were you consuming more of it in different ways or appreciating it more? Or purely on a quality basis, it was just higher in your eyes this year?
I think the latter. I mean, I try and watch something at least once a day. And that didn't change even when I was in the middle of shooting Mr. Robot or Homecoming or if I'm just writing or during the pandemic. I at least try and get one episode in of something a day, if not two, or a movie or something. So for me, it wasn't about my viewing habits. And we're going to talk again when we get into the list, we'll talk about, but the amount of unique points of views and the experimentation that was going on, and all the things that I just talked about in terms of redefining what storytelling can be, to the point where people legitimately don't know what to call it, a movie, a TV movie, a series. So it, for me, it's just, I don't know what it is. I don't know what happened, but something about all of the past years of my frustrations with TV sort of bubbled up to the surface. And, you know, this honestly segues nicely, and if we want to talk about this, into, I believe I angrily texted you, Andy, about the fact that you and Chris were sort of encouraging television shows to be more like expensive screensavers that you can fold laundry.
That's exactly what we were saying.
That's a direct quote.
No, it's good. Yeah.
And weirdly, a couple of
Newsmax S-Mail has logged into the chat.
And by the way, Flying Toasters was just greenlit straight to series on Paramount Plus. So
listen, I've heard this argument before. I mean, and you guys were making the argument, and then a couple of arguments. You guys have recently pitched this position.
I pitched Casey Bloys on a half-hour sitcom that's just the sound of a MacBook going on. Bum, and it's just that over and over again.
That to me was a disheartening part about the last couple of years. There is this weird tendency for certain shows to just occupy my time. It is not going to transport me to anywhere. It's not going to transform my way of looking at the world. It's not trying to do anything other than be this mild sedative entertainment value on my TV while I do other things. And there's a New Yorker article about it, you know, say what you will about the article, because I think it's been it's not a new phenomenon here. I think TV was born out of this need to preoccupy people so they can sell laundry detergent in between acts. So for me, I was concerned that somehow the pendulum was sort of swinging back that way, because I started to feel that the rise of this sort of laid back, low drama, low conflict storytelling. But again, I think 2020 exceeded my expectations and the pendulum sort of swung back. But what you guys tell me, because that's the argument I heard. I angrily threw my AirPods down on the ground, stomped them, had to buy a new pair so I could call you. But you tell me, what was your position? Because I heard laundry folding. That's when I stopped listening to the
I can't remember what show we were talking about.
I think actually it was when we were talking about watching baseball. I think that was the thing, because but to be fair, we were saying
that
was
hurts, that, Andy. That hurts.
It was because I think we were talking about watching the playoffs and kind of missing the rhythms of commercials and old fashioned TV watching, where you could get up, go to the during the commercial break, not during exposition scenes, and maybe get some more bugles or whatever you're snacking on that night, and then return. And it felt less stakesy, because I think the elevation of TV storytelling to a cinematic level of both skill and intensity is unquestionably a good thing. But TV's in our homes, and we have different days leading into our time in our homes, and we don't always want to be as completely magnetically stressily riveted. Not always. There are many different options for us on our TV boxes.
Kaya, that's right. Were we talking about baseball?
Yeah. No, I think you guys were talking about baseball and just like long periods of time when you have the TV on and you're just kind of like wandering in and out of.
Wait. No, I know what you were talking about. You know what you were doing? You were dissing on Fargo. That now I'm remembering. You were dissing on Fargo.
That's right.
There was a lot of like,
we were saying we liked watching commercials on baseball more than at times.
And you know, Andy, you already know this, but I'm a huge fan of this season. It's on my list. We'll get to it in a second. And for me to look at a show as technically precise as that show in terms of, the laundry list is long on that show, because everything is so dialed in and so beautiful to look at, and the rhythm and the music and the dialogue is so crackling, and it wasn't, you know, and you do have to fucking pay attention. You're going to get lost. And by the way, I am guilty of that. I don't think if you miss a scene of you're not going to come back next week and understand Mr. Robot. Like, it's not going to happen. I think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. And I pray to God that your wishes for TV never come true. Because I hated TV when it was like, it doesn't matter. You watch this episode or the next, who gives a shit? Like, it all doesn't make sense.
I think point is, if we can be
taking up 43 minutes of your time every week, that's all. Who cares?
I think my point is that type of TV has never gone away, isn't going away. And we generally don't ever discuss it, nor do we ever even experience it because we don't turn on the TV. Like we,
in fact, we often are like, that was fine. We don't need to even interrogate it. Like, I think that was for a show that probably, you know, a lot of our listeners adored, like Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso was a show that I feel like, Andy, you pretty much were like, nah, I don't want, because for exactly that reason, because you were like, this feels like laundry folding to TV.
It didn't say that specifically, but it's funny you mention that, because the night I tried Ted Lasso, all the laundry in my house got done. And so my wife wants me to watch it more. And I said, no, I have to stay focused. This is part of my job. I think charitably, and this might be kind of a hard thing to get my arms around, I kind of think, Sam, the things that you've been saying so far in this podcast are all part of the same point, which was this year it did feel kind of surprisingly like TV rebalanced itself. We've spent the last few years saying, you know, the highs were really high, but it was mostly kind of a mushy middle. There were shows that were a lot of shows were B minus shows, which would have been A's 20 years ago, but we got spoiled by the shows of the previous decade. And looking over my list and everybody's list, it does seem like there's a lot of high quality stuff in a lot of different lanes. Like half of my list are event series, limited series, and the other half aren't. And of the half that aren't, there's a silly comedy. And there's also a, you know, prestige drama, not just in the style of the previous decades, but literally the successor to it in Better Call Saul. So it does feel weirdly like it kind of figured itself out in a year when everything else completely fell apart.
Yeah. And I think, Sam, to your point about, I too watch something every day in some capacity at the end of every day. I actually, like, it was probably the highlight of my day during quarantine, which we are still in, which is basically getting through my work day, eating dinner, and then finally being able to like go somewhere else in a screen. And a lot of the shows that I picked, I think, in some ways overcompensated for my lack of experience this year. Like sensory wise, like we didn't have any experiences that I didn't this year worth noting. You know, I mostly was home. I saw a few friends and didn't really go anywhere. So a lot of the shows that I watched or that I loved basically were very transporting, not necessarily in a like watching The Expanse and it go to another planet way, but in a, you know, watching industry and watching people go out at night and be close to one another and do drugs and go to work and have consequences to all that stuff. To me, it was like very invigorating in a way that I don't even know if it would have been in 2019 and hopefully won't be in 2021, which isn't to take away from the quality of the show, which is immense and we've talked about a lot. But I think I was looking for something at the end of the day, whether it was light and airy or heavy and dark, that kind of like made up for the lack of stuff that I actually, you know, did this year.
Well, I'll add another thing to this. I didn't count it on your list, but I only have two returning shows on my list. One of them is an anthology, so it's a whole new storyline anyway. I do love the just to even keep going further down this road of how TV is sort of transforming itself. I do love this trend of shorter seasons. Not shorter. I mean, I do love shorter seasons. But I also love the trend of less seasons per series. Mm-hmm. We're going to wrap it up. We have a story. It's intentional. We have a beginning, middle, and end. And, you know, maybe three seasons, four seasons, and we're out. I feel like that trend is, again, hewing closer to a more intentional, precise form of storytelling. That we're not here to just preoccupy 22 hours a year of your time. That we're here to tell a very intentional story, and we don't know. And maybe showrunners are going to be encouraged to start planning things out ahead of time before they shoot seasons of their show or even start to write or break their first season. But for me, I think that's incredibly. I don't know what that is yet. I don't know what that is. And again, when we go through our list, the forms of all these shows like Fargo and Small Axe all vary now, and the format's going to get played around a lot. But I love this contraction of let's not do fluff seasons. Let's not do like, you know, seven or eight. That whole old antiquated way of thinking of going as far, as long as you can for as far as you can, is kind of like outdated now. I kind of like the encouragement of keeping it tighter.
I think it's worth noting that, and I agree with everything you're saying, and I look at my list, there are only three shows that were returning out of the 10. It's worth noting that the list would have looked a lot different had there not been a pandemic, because we were robbed of 2020 premieres for the returns of a lot of shows. Probably mm-hmm. the debuts of shows we're not even aware of yet, too. But, you know, there's no Succession, all of our favorite show, I know. like Barry probably would have come back. Like a lot of shows that have been on, Atlanta may have been ready this year. We're not sure about that. But a lot of favorite shows that were stuck on the shelf. But I do think, to your point, Sam, that like it is definitely no longer one size fits all. That's only a good thing creatively, and I think ultimately for the viewer. Since we're already talking about the aesthetic changes of television and cinema and television, why don't we start with this? So, Sam, when you sent in your list, one of the first things that jumped out, and probably this isn't surprising because of your own CV, was that a number of shows were, like your shows, Mr. Robot and Homecoming, were all directed by one person. So those shows on your list are your number 9 show, Queen's Gambit, your number 4 show, which is Small Axe, a collection of, he calls them films, Steve McQueen, and your number 2 show, Devs. And we sort of, on email, kind of said Fargo, I know, was directed by Noah and some of his collaborators, but you could kind of squeeze that in too if you want to talk about it, because there's no question that that show isn't completely aesthetically controlled by the taste of one person. So you've worked on TV this way. Now you're seeing more and more people do it this way. What does it bring? Why did it elevate these shows?
Well, I hinted to this a little bit earlier when I said that this is not a writer's medium. This is a filmmaker's medium. And again, I want to be very careful here, because I think Fincher always talks about this, and I 1000% agree. I am not into this auteur theory. There's not one person does not make a film, and one person certainly does not make a television series. But if you take a look at like Queen's Gambit, let's talk about Queen's Gambit. I think we're all fans. Was it on everyone's list? It was,
yeah,
right?
I believe so, yeah. Right?
I think that's the only one that was on all four lists.
It's Kaya's number 6. It's Andy's number 2. And it is my number 5.
Great.
Actually, Industry is the only other show that's on everybody's list, I think.
Mm-hmm. No, I think I May Destroy You. Again, that was That was correctly everyone's number 1 except Chris. but we'll get to that in a second. But so you take a show like Queen's Gambit.
Tell the readers of life how it feels to be a girl among all those men.
I don't mind it. Chess isn't always competitive. Chess can also be beautiful.
You're an orphan, Beth.
I'm fine being alone. I feel safe in an entire world of just 64 squares.
Well, creativity and psychosis often go hand in hand. Or for that matter, genius and madness.
Everything was synchronized to a cohesive vision on that show. I mean, you guys have talked about this. I don't want to like rehash, but everything from the costume design, from Beth's outfits looking like chess pieces, to the production design, the lighting. I can go on. And obviously Scott Frank being the writer and director of it all. But for me, this is what was beautiful about proof positive that if you take the medium for what it can bring to the screen, if you use all of those levers and it doesn't sacrifice the writing, it enhances the writing, and enhances the storytelling, you're going to get something really cohesive and outstanding like The Queen's Gambit. And then, of course, the one thing I'm going to say about that show is Anya Taylor-Joy. I mean, she is on. I mean, there's another standout performance that I want to highlight at some point when we talk about that show. But this performance to me, I mean, it was to play withdrawn, to play with using a lot of facial expressions, not a lot of dialogue. You know, that's a very tricky thing. A lot of people cannot access characters like that. Trust me. I know that we played around with it a lot in Mr. Robot and even in Homecoming. That's a hard thing for an actor to pull off. Not only did she pull it off, it was inviting. It was warm. I wanted to be with her. I wanted to hang with her. And I did not want to fold laundry or do the dishes. I could not take my eyes off of her. So that show, to me, just brilliantly sort of exemplifies what I'm talking about, how TV, and by the way, it needed to be episodic. I know that the book went through some incarnations, and I think, again, you guys have talked about this. It would have been a disservice to the book if they turned it into a 2-hour feature film. So it is just the prime example of what great episodic storytelling, TV storytelling, however you want to call it, works when all of the sort of departments and everyone comes together for a cohesive vision.
I couldn't agree more with that. And I mean, what's so brilliant about that show is that what Scott Frank gets the lion's share of the credit, but I think more than anything else, what he did was he conducted it like a symphony, all the departments, you know, it was all in concert in a beautiful way. And we spoke to him about that when he was on the show. Wanted to just, as a quick counter before we move on to other subject, bring up devs.
What is devs?
This is the only principle you need to understand. Nothing ever happens without a reason. Everything was determined by something prior.
You knew I was going to come here.
The sense that you were participating in life was only ever an illusion. Life is just something we watch unfold.
Which is a show that we covered pretty exhaustively on the podcast. It would have made a long list, I think, probably, for at least me and Chris, had we done a longer list. But I'm wondering, for me, ultimately, where I felt it faltered was the script and the story. It was totally transporting as a directorial exercise by Alex Garland. You may just reject that premise outright, but I was wondering if its high placement on your list had something to do with the level of execution purely of the visuals, and if that is ever enough for you.
No, it was the storytelling. I got to be honest with you. I can't, again, I'm probably going to get crucified and people are going to throw out great examples like Arrival and I'm sure other sci-fi films that I'm not thinking of right now, but this is one of the best pieces of sci-fi storytelling I have seen in a long time, because it was not reliant on set pieces. It was reliant on fucking conversations about determinism. I mean, this, and it was dramatic and entertaining.
To be fair, so is this podcast, but go on.
That scene when Alison Pill is talking about how this is happening right now and you know every choice, that you've seen every choice that's about to happen, yet you're still going to make those choices.
The one on the dam?
On
the dam.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was a great scene. I mean, the Chinese century scene in the bathtub with that, that guy was great. The guy who played the security guard. I can't remember his name. There are so many great moments in that show, but it's pure sci-fi. I mean, it does not pull punches in terms of the intellect. It does not water anything down. It does not try and hit you with any gotcha twists or anything. It really honestly wanted to explore this idea of free will and predestination in the most interesting and intellectual way, but it never was boring to me. It always sucked me in. I mean, it was one of those shows. I mean, we're going to talk about this to a certain extent, but one of the reasons why I got excited about TV this year is nothing really piled up on a lot of these shows. When it fucking came on my Hulu thing, I couldn't wait. I was waiting for the minutes to count.
So that down. Were there shows like that though, where you were like, I'm not so sure if I want to, I mean, you don't have to name them if you don't want to, but like, were there some shows that maybe you started?
Were there homework shows?
Yeah. Yes. And then they became homework.
Well, if it became homework, I usually, that was when just I stopped. Checked out. I don't try and force myself to get through something unless I think there's a couple elements in there where I'm like hoping and praying that they pull it out. But usually, and there was one show that I really had high promise for, and I really don't want to name names, but man, it started off strong. And then, yeah. And then I usually bail after a while. And I'm like,
Sam, we agreed we wouldn't talk about Briar Patch on this podcast. We
are not allowed to talk about Briar Patch.
I know. I know. The other, one thing that you three, Kaya, Chris, and Sam all have in common is there are a beloved genre of rom-coms on everybody's list.
Yes. Hell yeah, brother.
I know Sam is chomping at the bit because people might not realize this. Sam loves rom-coms. This is true.
Julia Roberts, come on.
Classic rom-com, Homecoming. You definitely were like, time to use those chops again.
By the way, I am envious. I wish I could do an amazing rom-com, but
Homecoming happens in the My Best Friend's Wedding extended universe. Little known fact.
It does. It does. Yeah.
That's true because of Dermot, right?
Yeah. That was not an accident, Andy.
So I'm just looking at Kaya's list, and she's got Search Party's not a rom-com, but it is a half hour. Love Life at 7. Normal People, there's some com, a lot of rom.
There's very little com.
I won't. I'm just sort of, I'm kind of squinting my way, wondering if we should also just talk about half hours. But since we're talking about rom-coms, Kaya, you have High Fidelity and Love Life on your list.
Why do you need a boyfriend right now? This isn't Jane Austen times. I'm sorry.
I'm just having a small life panic.
I just want to be the kind of woman who knows what she wants and she's not afraid to go after it.
You should be loved for the little derp-de-derp that you are.
Talk about why, and then I know the boys also want to chime in on these particular shows.
Yeah, I mean, I just found both of those shows like so enjoyable to watch. High Fidelity a little bit more than Love Life, but I mean, it's just kind of like you take a really charming lead and you surround them with really charming people, and it just makes like a really enjoyable television. And I mean, I think like Love Life in particular, like, I don't know if Sam will like this, but it was just so easy to watch. And it was just so like glossy and everybody looks so nice and like the interior.
Kaya, Love Life is on my list, Kaya.
No, I know. And that's why I'm interested to hear like why you liked it.
Because... I didn't say a show needs to be hard to watch. I just said you should watch the show when you're watching the show. That's all.
By the way, we're not going to put the video up. There's just unfolded clothes everywhere in Sam's screen right now.
He just puts on the same new black sweatshirt every day. He's got 365 of them.
But wait, Kai, I have a question for you because I know you said it's easy to watch. I also found the show easy to watch and a pleasure to watch. Did you find it easy to watch because you could do other things while you were watching it? Or did you just want to hang with the show?
I think for Love Life, yeah. I mean, the story wasn't like super hard to follow if you missed like a few minutes. And not like I was getting up and leaving the room, but I think I mentioned last year that I, you know, tend to look at my phone while I watch TV. So that's a habit I'm really trying to break this year. And yeah, and so it's like, if you miss a moment, like you're not going to be completely lost. But then also, I mean, I just like, I don't know. I felt like I could just watch like 100 more of that. Like if they Me made too. Like 100 more yeah. episodes, like I would watch every single 100. One of them. And then I know they're doing season 2 with William Harper Jackson, who I think that's going to be like really good. And yeah, it's just like a good show. Like I wouldn't call it great, but it was just like extremely charming and just like really, really fun to watch.
To me, both Love Life, which would have been on my long list, and High Fidelity, which made my list, they're like pop standards. And it, you know, the bones of the thing work already. It's really just about who's singing the song. And you put Zoe Kravitz in a situation where she has to choose between two guys and has a group of funny friends and an interesting job. And it's just kind of like, I'm pretty into it. And like the way they kind of like rooted it in, you know, like a very contemporary New York City vibe, I thought really, really just worked for the show. And I honestly, a lot of things were going against that show, and it's a shame it got canceled, but rebooting a Nick Hornby novel and a John Cusack movie 20 years after the fact that was largely rooted in like a like male introspective experience and making it this part for Zoe Kravitz to play, everything about it worked. And it's really one of the true bummers of the year that show's not going to be able to come back.
Yeah,
one of the
absolutely.
Things that I'm picking up on from you guys that I appreciate is for years, we've talked about just having so much choice on television. You could watch anything at any time. But this year, at least, our lists are kind of reflective of the new reality that you can get pretty high quality servings of almost any cuisine you want. Yeah. That we were well serviced by TV in a way, right? Because everybody likes rom-coms and they've been struggling at the movies in the last few years. And then also this year you couldn't go to the movies, but here you got stuff that actually scratched that same itch in a satisfying way, but in a way that made sense for television. the flip side to that, in terms of things that we usually get at the movies, is big budget franchise management. And that's why we got to talk about Mando.
Show me the one whose safety deemed such destruction. You must reunite it with its own kind.
Where?
This you must determine. The songs of eons past tell of battles between Mandalore the Great and an order of sorcerers called Jedi.
You expect me to search the galaxy and deliver this creature to a race of enemy sorcerers?
This is the way.
This is the way.
Which we're already talking about anyway, constantly week to week, and just really enjoying it. And I think that we are certainly not alone in that. But Sam, you are the same age as Chris and I are, and you have, you know, a complicated relationship, I think, to both nostalgia and big budget franchise management on the big screen. The show is on your list. What does it do right?
You know, I think Favreau, it was really smart. So weirdly, I'm going to kind of contradict myself here. He kind of went old school mm-hmm. with the sort of form of storytelling here, because I think Star Wars is such this big monstrosity now. It's so weighty with all the themes and the characters and the worlds that he just said, I'm going to focus this on this one lane. And it's it's basically a travelogue. I mean, I remember watching Incredible Hulk, Bill Bixby yeah. back in the day. It reminds me a lot of that. There's a mission per episode. And so it's perfect for, so basically, number one, he did not treat it like 8-hour movie or 9-hour movie or however many episodes it is. He treated it like a television show. He gave sort of the respect to the episodic storytelling format that he put it on. And, you know, I remember expecting, I don't know what you guys were expecting, but I remember when I first started seeing the pictures, I was like, okay, this is it. This is like the hard R-rated Star Wars that we've been like dreaming about since we were little kids. And it's not that. In fact, it's pretty family friendly. I mean, very sort of almost obnoxiously so family friendly with that cute baby Yoda. But it fucking works again, because he kept it simple and made it about the characters and made it about this very simple relationship that could have easily been sentimental, not sentimental at all. And then, I'm going to say this again as a knock on feature films. I really don't want to knock feature films. By the way, guys, just for the record, for the audience, I love going to the movies pre-pandemic. I went to the movies every weekend. I plan on doing that when it's safe again. But this show, and
don't
I,
try and walk it back. You try to close multiplexes, man. That's what you're doing here.
Just trying just to cancel.
You're not welcome in Chicago in multiplexes.
Taking a wrecking ball to the New Beverly.
Best VFX I've seen in a long. I'm including.
It's a game changer, right?
Yes. And you know, I'm such a dork that I, you know, twisted John's arm and he invited me down to, they shoot that whole thing in a warehouse in Manhattan Beach somewhere. Yes. with these LED screens, and they don't go anywhere. They go to a warehouse, and for it to fucking look as good as it does. And then I compare it to some of the movies that have, I assume, bigger budgets, and for the VFX to just like sort of outweigh them in such a radical way. I think it's, this show's like phenomenal, working on every level.
I've yeah. been thinking about Mandalorian for the last couple of weeks, just because of the quality of the last two episodes, especially. Now, when this episode comes out, there will have been another one since the Boba Fett
the tragedy.
Episode. But I've been thinking a lot about the Ahsoka Tano episode and the tragedy. And I was thinking, you know, like basically every Mandalorian episode has the same mechanics. It's like he has an initial quest. He shows up where he needs to be. The person who he's going to meet's like, I'll give you what you want, but you have to do this for me. And he's like, oh, twist my arm. And he does a side mission for that other character. And then at the end of the episode, typically finds out he has yet another step to go in his quest to help Baby Yoda or find more Mandalorians or whatever he's doing. And that's not altogether different than New Hope and Empire. Like, the actual plot mechanics are still very, very much rooted in Star Wars storytelling. The difference between Mandalorian and the sequels that we just kind of got through over the last 6 years or 7 years is that Mandalorian understands that what we really want out of Star Wars is to sit in the cockpit and hand Baby Yoda the little silver ball. Or we want the Mandalorian character and Ahsoka to hang out for a little while and get to know each other and walk around in circles around each other in a cool setting. We don't constantly need to be jumping in hyperspace from planet to planet every 5 seconds.
And with that's a bunch of expository dialogue shoved in there. And I'm like,
I think that sometimes we mistake what it is we actually want out of these things. You know, we confuse it. Like, I don't actually expect Star Wars to answer any epistemological or existential questions I have about heroism in the universe or anything. I actually just love the vibes. And that's what this show really is a return to Big Mos Eisley mood, you know, like just hanging out in weird places with weird creatures while people give like Howard Hawksy dialogue back and forth to one another.
Yeah. It's great. It's also with the music. I love that score. And it's kind of a throwback to Westerns, I think.
Yeah, Spaghetti Westerns.
I feel like, you know, he does not, he does not find the mythology precious. It's not about the fuck the mythology. Like, fucking tell me a good story and I'll feel that. I'll feel that underneath. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like that's where some of these shows sometimes, when they take that too seriously and when they have to feel like they got to dole out pieces of the mythology to you every... I mean, he did none of that. And by the way, I mean, I guess we're talking spoilers here because you spoiled the whole thing. I didn't know that they were ever going to cross paths with the Jedi. But when I saw that episode and that title came up, The Jedi, that's how you reward me with the mythology.
Yeah.
Tell me a good story. Don't even let me think about that. Let me care about these characters in the world. Let me marvel again at all these new terrains and worlds. Like I remember feeling when I first saw the original Star Wars. Let me just marvel at that, these little nooks and crannies, and let my imagination run wild. And then you slip in the Jedi on top of all of that. I mean, that's great. That to me, he knows what he's doing. I mean, that show's like really working on all cylinders, because I don't think anybody expected that to come. And I think in general, what Star Wars is based on is starting off with that. And the fact that they didn't need to, and that was just like the cherry on top.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the show's working then.
It's best case scenario, because I think that certainly when the Disney Plus was announced, and like, it was obviously going to be flooded with content from the big brands. And as we're recording on Thursday, the 10th, the apparently not really that retired Bob Iger is saying there's going to be 10 new Star Wars shows, 10 new Marvel shows, yada, yada, yada. The most cynical takeaway from that is, well, yeah, they're just going to print money. Like, you just make more of the thing and then you can make more returns from it. But what's interesting potentially is that it might allow some kind of cross-medium dialogue to do what you were speaking to, Sam, at the beginning, which is put things in the right shape boxes. You know, what story fits best where? And I am the farthest thing today's podcast has from Sean Fennessy, but a perfect 90 minutes of story in a movie is probably the perfect delivery vehicle for story, but it has to be a 90 minute story or a, you know, 120 minute story. And, you know, when you end up with things that are just in the wrong shape box, everyone's frustrated. And that's probably the gentlest criticism I'll give on this podcast about Rise of Skywalker, but that wasn't a 2-hour and 15-minute movie. I mean, I'm not saying it was a TV show either, but it certainly wasn't that. And so hopefully, as things become one in terms of what screen they're on, hopefully we can start thinking of it as a dialogue and not just a monologue in terms of between TV and movies, that maybe they can learn a little bit from each other as filmmakers feel more free to be like, well, this story is going to fit better here. Whereas a movie, I'm still going to make a movie, but if I have something that is better suited to this medium, right? Because as you said, Sam, like Queen's Gambit, they tried to make a movie for 40 years and thank goodness they didn't.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200 or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
Sam, you were talking about, as Andy's just mentioning, the TV and movies thing. I thought we would be remiss if we didn't give you the floor to talk about Small Axe for a second, which I think we could debate whether or not it should be on your list as a TV show, on a best TV podcast. But I also would love to hear your thoughts on what McQueen did there.
These are new types of human beings. They are not demoralized or defeated persons. They are leaders, but are rooted deep among those they lead.
We mustn't be victims, but protagonists of our stories.
Don't you think it's time things were different?
As individuals, we have an impossible battle. As a collective, we stand a chance.
Well, okay, so on the one hand, and I think Steve McQueen, he came out and said these are films, this is not a TV show. But here's the thing. I'm judging Small Axe. So I'm not judging Mangrove, which is fucking fantastic, or Lover's Rock. I'm judging the entire experience. And by the way, I mean, for not a TV show to be releasing an episode every week, it feels a little odd. But yeah. For me, Small Axe, that's the banner that these films are collected under, is no different than Black Mirror, Twilight Zone. These are standalone episodes, standalone stories, but they're all connected by a theme. And in this case, a time and place in London. And for me, I feel like as a whole, if you want to judge each film on its own, they're fantastic. But I think he's doing himself a disservice because as a series, it's fucking groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I'm talking about right here. This, what he's doing is changing the landscape of whatever you want to call episodic storytelling. For whatever reason, TV has become a pejorative. That word, if you say it to a serious filmmaker, they want to throw up. I mean, don't ever say it around Christopher Nolan. I mean, don't ever say streaming around Christopher Nolan. He's going to like flip out, right?
Even be named Max and go near Christopher Nolan.
Right. But if you want to talk about a collection of feature films, you know, surrounding a theme that's connected, okay, whatever you want to fucking call that, I call that episodic storytelling. But if you want to change that moniker to something else, my point is that he's redefining the possibilities here, because you know, unlike the rhythms of Twilight Zone, or, and again, I used to watch all those shows, you know, Tales from the Crypt and Outer Limits and Alfred Hitchcock.
Sam, if you're watching Outer Banks, you've come to the right podcast, because Kai and I are ready to talk about it.
That's a show. I have not seen that show, but I've heard a lot of people talk about it. Is that the show?
That is peak laundry folding show.
Yeah, I literally did fold laundry to that show.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind next time I'm folding laundry. But he's taking that formula of, you know, now I'm not going to do that around genre. I'm going to do that around theme. And it just, for me, it's so special. And to do it on the level that he's doing it, you know, to do it, to release them collectively like that, I think it's pretty extraordinary. And I get excited because, again, I think you talk about, have you guys seen it? It's not on any of your lists.
Yeah,
right?
I've seen Mangrove Shock and Lover's Rock.
I can't wait to watch it.
You haven't seen it.
I just did.
Chris, are you disagreeing with me?
No, I mean, I just did the big picture of the best of the year, and Adam and Sean both had small acts movies on their list, and I would have considered it movies just the same way that Soderbergh's putting out a movie tonight on HBO Max. I would call that a movie. I would consider like the small acts, even though it's a collection, to be movies. But I definitely love where you're coming from here, and I hope more people, more directors get an opportunity to do the kind of thing that McQueen is doing.
So you would have you're just not considering it in the TV.
Yeah. I mean, I think
in the TV list,
he's definitely one of like the five best directors alive. And that's insane.
By the way, just real quick aside, Widows, fucking great film. One of the best heist films I've ever seen.
I like Widows.
Love Widows.
And no one talks about it. No one talks about it. It's crazy. I think
it's going to have like 5 years from now, like people are obsessed with Widows kind of thing. Cause that's a movie that will stand the test of time because of just the sheer amount of quality that went into it.
I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival months before it came out. And I thought, oh my God, your head's going to explode. Cause you're a big heist movie fan, yeah, yeah, right? And I just thought, oh, this is going to do.
I'm also obligated to support whatever Colin Farrell does, you know?
Especially when he does it like that. Yeah. With that
oh
accent.
My God.
Chris, I want to, a word that just came up before when we were talking about Mandalorian was vibes. Mm. Vibes are really key, I think, to today's television landscape, because you can switch between services, but you can also just flip between vibes very intensely and kind of wonderfully. And that, no, I don't know if any show was vibier in some ways than 000, which is on both of our lists.
This token transfers $31 million as soon as the product leaves Mexican waters.
Mexico nos entrenó para ser los mejores, y lo somos.
The rest will be transferred when the shipment arrives at Gioia Tauro.
Catai 5,000 kg, make i prezzi sempre.
Bigger risk than usual.
Bigger the risk, greater the profit.
It's not necessarily a posy vibe, but it is a very big and very heavy mood, and it was both of our favorites.
I can't remember what show me and our buddy Sam Donsky were talking about on text when I think I had expressed kind of some skepticism about some show that he liked. And he was like, lol, sorry, it's not about robbing cartels. Like, which I think is sometimes, you know, fairly or unfairly, like considered like the very thing in the world that I look for. Yeah, 000 for me was really cool on a number of levels. First of all, I thought it was one of the few shows that wound up on my list that recovered from some missteps in the beginning. So I thought that the first episode or two of 000 were like, okay, and I would definitely have just kept watching it, but that the season progressed to like near like operatic, you know, levels towards the end. And the final two episodes, I think, are two of my favorite episodes of the year. And in the same way that Sam's been talking about filmmakers taking advantage of this opportunity to tell stories episodically, I thought that this show, one of the best shows that really took in the global stage that television can encompass now. Now, obviously, there's a lot of market forces driving that. Netflix wants shows that appeal to an international audience. I'm sure Amazon wants the same. I think it helps if you're pitching a show probably to say, oh, and we could have like this part of the show would appeal to a South American audience or a China audience or a European audience or whatever. 000 was simply a story that needed to be told with this like wide of a canvas. And I thought, despite the fact that I think a lot of different people, like obviously Maurizio Katz and Stefano Salima both worked on it. And there was several directors who worked on the show. It felt like a singularity of vision, no matter who you want to ascribe that vision to. The music from Mogwai, the cinematography, the grittiness of the direction, the distance it held its characters at so that you never felt as morally complicit, I think, in their behavior as you do sometimes when you watch shows that romanticize crime a little bit more. But it's at the same time, you felt like, you know, it was very viscerally exciting to watch it. I just thought it was a tremendous achievement on a number of levels in that way.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I loved watching it, but I really also like it for the reasons you were just describing, Chris, that it really is a great placeholder and catch-all for one of the things that's most exciting about TV right now, which is just how fully global it is. And there are, you can, and it, now people are realizing, the streamers are realizing, certainly as pandemic related delays start to pile up on their end. I feel like HBO Max just said one of their new categories is just going to be like international crime.
Yeah.
So of course I'm going to bookmark that. But like,
fuck yeah. Yeah.
Whether it's me watching, whether it's me watching Call My Agent on Netflix, The French Show, or I really loved watching Dark season 3.
I'm so proud of you for wrenching that in.
I had to, but also like Dark, a show that Sam first turned me onto a few years ago, season 3, loved watching it. Didn't make my top 10 this year, but would have made like a long list. It's exciting to see familiar stories, whether it's Chris's beloved cartel robbing or my beloved agent calling, told through the lens of different cultures and different perspectives. And as to your point, Chris, 000, Italian director Stefano Salima, Maurizio Katz, brilliant Mexican writer, the most incredible score from the Scottish band Mogwai, the best episodes are filmed in Africa and or set in Africa. And the most incredible thing of all of it filmed in a warehouse in Manhattan Beach. I mean, and they made it look like that. Even the boat scenes, it's amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
And I would also just say that I don't know necessarily that a character like Manuel, who becomes not quite the star of the show, but one of the two lead characters or three lead characters at the end, by the end of the show, is on a prestige drama 5 years ago. I just don't know if they make a show about that guy and spend as much time interrogating that character.
Also, star-making performance. TV can still do that for Harold Torres.
Yeah, absolutely. Sam, did you see that at all?
I don't think I did. I think I remember you texting me about it.
Yeah.
I think I added it to my list, but to watch, but I never got a chance to check it out.
Chris and I'm
excited by it though. No, I was just saying, go ahead.
It's like you're listening to the podcast, but you're here. I was going to pivot because Chris and I have spent the last few weeks raving about industry and talking to the creators of industry.
Yeah.
We love industry, but it was so cool.
I was
when
so excited.
It appears
on, your list.
On Sam's list and on Kaya's list. And we
Kaya has no choice. She has been indoctrinated into it.
Yeah, but Kaya is very comfortable disliking things that we make her.
Well, but your guys' enthusiasm for that show over the past, like it literally wasn't going to make my list like 3 weeks ago, but then just like listening to you guys talk about it week after week, I was like, I have to put it on.
It's like Wild Wild Country though. We're just like, you will believe in industry.
Why are you here?
I think this is the closest thing to a meritocracy there is.
Wake up!
People know what they're joining.
I only want to be judged on the strength of my abilities.
Can I say, Mai Hala? I got to give a shout out to her.
Yeah,
she's incredible.
Mahala Harold, yeah.
Incredible performance. She actually, Emmy directed her in her Modern Love episode. And
Sam is no David Benioff, so he's referring to his talented, wonderful wife, Emmy Rossum, who directed an episode of the anthology series Modern Love, starring Mahala,
who's, I mean, Emmy's just amazing at casting, right? Because she was the one that encouraged me to think about Rami when we were looking for Elliot's for Mr. Robot. But Mahala, I mean, just out of nowhere.
That was a tough break for me because I know that I was down to the final two there.
I know,
but that's
I know,
okay.
Chris. So you don't need to bring that up right now. But no, Mahala, honestly, her, and I think you guys have talked about this already, but that relationship that she has with Eric. I can't remember the actor's name.
It's Ken Leung. Yeah.
So good. So special. So unique. I mean, you know, I don't want to get into the, I'm not going to try and pull a race card here, but I do feel like part of the reason why I'm excited by this season of television is the points of views that we're getting to experience. That is the gold mine of storytelling. That is the untapped gold. I keep saying this to people because I feel like in the industry right now, diversity is like high on everyone's priority list, but it's often viewed through the wrong lens. It's like, okay, let's take this script we've already written mm-hmm. and just make the main character black or make the main character gay. That's not the point. The point is that you gotta like look through that world, through that perspective, through that background. And a lot of shows on our list, I mean, Small Axe, I May Destroy You, hopefully we'll talk about that in a second. But yeah. This show, Industry, and it's never so pointed. I mean, that's the thing. It's not about, the show doesn't suddenly become about race, but it definitely through that lens, you get to experience, you know, again, in the example of Industry, it's pretty much a workplace drama. Right. The setting and the way and the sort of the setup for the show is not incredibly unique. We've seen that before. Young person joins a workplace, and then we sort of hang with that person and their colleagues and their coworkers. But because it's
that's Superstore
through that's a lot of shows. That's the fucking Office. But because it's done through this unique new lens that we've typically not seen in not just TV films. And a lot of forms of storytelling, it becomes immediately exciting and just sort of leaps off the screen. I'm so happy that they renewed it for a second season because I honestly was worried. It didn't seem like it was getting a lot of ratings. Emmy and I know that they dumped like five, like the rest of the episodes. Like
they put up three
and
then they did three in a weekly release. And then they put up the last five on HBO Max.
So this is, we started it. We were not going to binge the whole thing. Couldn't stop. Yep. Watch the whole thing in a row.
Kaya, what was it that kind of turned it for you? Because I know you said that you were like, it wouldn't make my list if I had just off the bat, but our enthusiasm convinced you. But what was it really beyond us just talking about it all the time?
I mean, I think it really picked up speed in like the last three episodes, which I think were Nutcracker. and then there was one in between Nutcracker and the finale, right?
Pre-crisis activity, I think, second to last one. Yeah.
Yeah. So like before, like the first few episodes, like it did kind of feel to me just kind of like a lot of drugs, a lot of sex. Let's just like throw a lot of like gratuitous stuff at the screen and like use that to like make it pop and like make it like this is not just like a workplace drama. But by the end, when you're just really like, why are these people doing these things like the way they're doing them? And I've seen some criticism of the show being like, the motivations of these characters were not clear. And it's like, I don't think that the motivations of the characters were clear to themselves. And I think that's like what it made it interesting, like, especially in like, spoiler alert, in the final episode when Harper...
Oh, la, la, la. I'm sure Harper does something. Yeah, I'm rationing it because I love it so much. Now that it's been renewed... I will finish the season, but I was worried that it was all I had left.
Dude, I was actually the other day. I was the score for this show is amazing.
I wanted to shout that out
by Nathan McKay. Yeah, and I was listening to the score actually while I was taking a walk, and this was after we had after I'd finished the season. I think maybe it was like Sunday night, and I was bummed because I was walking around and I was like, I wonder. It was almost like melancholy because I was thinking about the show not coming back. And now it's like almost ecstatic because I know it is coming back. It takes on this whole new quality to know that we're going to get to spend more time with these characters.
Let's make the jump that Sam was suggesting and talk about I May Destroy You.
I just smashed your phone.
I don't know. Cool, where did you get that?
I just wanted to know how did last night end? Got this thing in my head of like this guy.
Because now you're calling it something that I never.
I know what you're doing.
I'm great as long as I'm around people. I did to, you know, just gather the pieces, any of the pieces.
which was number one for me, number one for Sam, I believe.
It was correctly number one for everyone but Chris.
And
it is objectively the number one show of the year, and it's not even close.
We'll let Chris defend himself in a minute, but first let's not steal Michaela's spotlight and basically say that, you know, to your point, Sam, about the great, I mean, still truly, even after these last 2 years, the great market inefficiency in storytelling is still a full diversity of perspective. And to Chris's point about, especially this year, wanting to travel outside of our homes however we possibly can, I just think no show was a more titanic achievement on both of those fronts, because this was a show set in our world, at least pre-pandemic world, obviously a different country in a different city, but it was a complete whole body trip to one woman's experience with her family, with her friends, with her life, with her work, with her art, with her body. And it was, it's a staggering achievement. It was a whole window into another existence that was done with such style, such skill, such wit and grace and emotion. I mean, that was, we talked about it week to week, but it could have been, it's hard to do any of the individual things that show did well. And it did all of them well, from
all of them.
Introducing new actors and stars right before our eyes to taking us to parts of London, a city that Chris likes to say he's been to a lot, but that we may have not seen before, to, you know, dealing with some of the most searing subject matter imaginable and doing so with just like bountiful humanity and humor. You know, it's a staggering achievement that I kind of still can't believe existed, because week after week we were like, how much longer can she keep this up? And she kept it up.
The layers that she was, you're talking about sexual assault. You're talking about the dealing with the trauma from that. And you're talking about consent in all of these different nuanced, subtle ways. And I know these are weighty, heavy topics that shows are so scared to deal with and face. And when they do, it's done with such delicacy because it's so fragile. And she doesn't do any of that. She handles it. She just goes right into it, dives right in deep into it. And then it's not homework. It's entertaining. It's funny. It's relatable. The performances are outstanding. The filmmaking is like on a, you know, it's like you said, the staggering achievement. I am being entertained while we're talking about something as personal and as traumatic as sexual assault. How the fuck do you do that? How the fuck does that person do that? And she, and by the way, the other thing about that show, she does it and it feels effortless. I enjoy, like, you know, Kaya, you were talking about how it's an easy watch. That show is an easy watch. It could not, it should not have been any, I mean, for me.
There's some moments.
Okay. No, I know what you mean.
There's some moments. But it was an easy watch. I mean, that's one of those shows Emmy and I clicked on. Could not wait. Waiting on the HBO app to see when that.
Oh, yeah. I should say, what I mean is, even though I knew it would be challenging at times, I was eager to do it. You know, it was never homework. And that's
also,
to
like,
me, that's even more
just
impressive.
In the same way, like, you would, I know this is a strange comparison, but in the same way that you would be excited to get a new episode of Lost or a new episode of Game of Thrones, like, I legitimately had no idea where that show was going. Like,
oh my God.
And the thing that I you know, their London setting probably unites them a little bit, industry and I May Destroy You, but those two shows are very exciting for me because they feel like what it feels like to be alive right now. You know, like, it's pretty rare for culture to catch up with the times. You know, usually you're like lagging behind a little bit by the time the ship turns. And, you know, I mean, you get lots of shows that very poorly integrate iPhone usage in, or it's like text bubbles and stuff like that. But these two shows definitely had an energy and an immediacy and a fluency with what I think people feel like when they are out in a city and doing things, and the dangers and the thrills that come along with that. I mean, Kai, I don't know if you have stuff you wanted to add about Destroy You, because I know it's your favorite show.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, like, I think it was just so incredibly powerful and impressive the way that Michaela Cole was able to take, like, an incredibly personal story. Like, this literally was mined from her life. Like, she was sexually assaulted while taking a break from writing, and just create something that was, like, so expansive in what it covered and so applicable, like you said, to like the human experience and like how it feels to be alive right now, and like touch on consent, touch on love, touch on friendship, touch on the Black experience, touch on reaction to social media. I mean, I think by far my favorite episode was the one where she exposes like her fellow writer for like taking the condom off during sex. And it's like, that is just never something you've seen on TV before. And it was such a powerful experience for her in the moment. But then after that, you see her like going to social media to like affirm what she just did. And it's just like the whole show just felt like so intentional, so precise, just like, yeah, just extremely, extremely well done.
I want to add, I just want to piggyback on that for a second, because you brought up social media. And you know, Chris, you brought up the tech of it all. That was also done so well as to not even date itself, even though it's literally talking about Twitter and Instagram and we're having the text bubbles. It just felt so lived in.
It felt baked into the characters' lives.
Exactly. It was not just a superficial way to get characters communicating. It was part of their identity, part of how they talked. How they interacted with one another. Their storylines were sort of shaped by what happens on social media in a way, and not in like a celebrity kind of way, in a way that I think people, you know, just walking about would be affected by it. I think
the funniest scene in that series was when she's in the grocery store checking out and her car gets declined. And the checkout person like takes a selfie of her and is like, haha, this like famous Twitter person, like her card just got declined.
What else should we talk about here? What else do we have to go over?
Well, I thought that we could begin to turn the corner, but we just talked about our number one show. We need to give a little space for Chris to defend his number one, but also for me to support him because I love the show too. And I had originally suggested we talk about Better Call Saul along with Ozark, which is on Chris's list and Kaya's list, under the rubric of like, let's not overthink this, because for as much as we've spent this podcast talking about the new bold new directions of storytelling on television, et cetera, those are different examples, but taken from a similar playbook and one that still works when it's done right.
I can't go back to being Jimmy McGill. That name is burned. This is a fresh start. This is how I move forward. And I like it.
We all make our choices. And those choices, they put us on a road. Sometimes those choices seem small, but they put you on the road. You think about getting off, but eventually you're back on it.
So there, I would actually also bring The Crown into this too. Because I think that Crown, Ozark, and Saul in different ways did a kind of classic 2010 style of television in an elevated level. Ozark's obviously a very pulpy, at times implausible show. I thought that the third season was like an incredible revival for it. I thought it dipped a little bit in the second season, and that the third season was absolutely nail-biting and just white-knuckled it through. And often in later seasons of dramas, when they try to bring in a new character, you wind up kind of just distracting it from the real reason people are watching the show in the first place. And Ozark kind of broke that rule by introducing this the character that's plays Laura Linney's brother, and it's Tom Pelfrey, who's plays Joseph Mankiewicz in Mank, and he is unbelievable on the show, like just a complete live wire. One of my favorite performances of the year. So I wanted to shout that out and include Ozark in my list. Also, I fucking love Ozark. And then Saul. I don't know. I mean, like, you guys have me second guessing myself a little bit because of the unanimity of your choices here.
Good.
But I think that Saul is on another level from basically all TV. Like, I think that the story Saul's telling is in some ways more impressive than the one that Breaking Bad told. And the way in which it is working towards a point in time that we already know is coming, but still is managing to keep the suspense there. And the level of writing, I think, is kind of unparalleled. The intricacy of the writing, the depth of the characterizations, and the performances across the board, specifically the ones I think we've shouted out over and over again, which is the trio of Odenkirk, Racy Horn, and this year, Tony Dalton, who played Lalo. I don't know. I mean, I was getting real Sopranos fumes, and and Mad Men fumes and Breaking Bad fumes when I was watching the show. I was like, this is about as good as you can make an hour long drama on TV.
Do you think it's better? Are you one of those on the, is better than Breaking Bad? Is it going to exceed Breaking Bad?
I'm pretty open about the fact that I find the numerical slotting of this stuff to be pretty silly. Like, I think that you can have a group of shows. Like, to me, it would be more interesting almost to look at our top tens and say the tiers, mm-hmm. which two or three shows are just clearly a cut above. And if we were doing that, I would probably put Destroy You and Saul in a category of their own.
I meant you referenced Breaking Bad. I was asking, do you think it will surpass Breaking Bad in your eye in terms of the better show?
I'll say that there are characters on Saul that I am more invested in than almost any character that was on Bad, with a few exceptions.
Wow. Yeah. I agree with that. I also think that I just don't, echoing Chris's disdain of comparing things, to me, it's just you can like a band and you can like their early work and you can appreciate their later work. I just feel like what's part of the incredible thing about Saul is watching the way Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould and their regular group of collaborators on all sides of the camera have just refined their skills and the directions they've refined them in. And they're very different shows and they hit different pleasure centers. And obviously they've built their audiences and their fandom quite differently. But I really enjoy, I mean, you can't separate them because I don't think I would be watching Better Call Saul if we hadn't loved Breaking Bad, but you also, it wouldn't exist if we hadn't had Breaking Bad. And so yeah. I just think it's a pretty unique achievement, and just the level of technical skill. It's obviously under different economic settings and less limited than Queen's Gambit, but those are the two shows that I would hold up and be like, every department is just in sync, you know, in a way that just from a production standpoint, having gone through it once, I really admire that. Also, it's nice to go back to New Mexico every
night. That's right. You know? Sweet old ABQ.
Sam only made one trip, so we didn't really give him the full.
This is true.
Should we do, we've done great, I think. We've done a great job with our timing, with our conversation. Should we do a lightning round around the horn? Because there are a couple things on each of our list that we might want to champion, or even some honorable mentions we want to say.
I definitely want to talk about my second favorite performance of the year.
Do it.
Which is Ethan Hawke in The Good Lord.
Yeah,
Bird.
Please.
Just missed our list.
Andy and I fucked up because I think we fell behind on
you
Good Lord
up.
Bird, and then we
you
got kind
up.
of...
you fucked up. It's a fucking great show. Again, tackling a subject like slavery but having incredible, being on an entertaining level that it had no right to be on. It's not an austere period piece. It is going for it. And at the center of it is this incredible, ferocious performance by Ethan Hawke. I mean, I'd be hard pressed to name a better performance. It's so good. It's so riveting. It is the definition of can't look away. I mean, talking about things, talking about us being distracted. And by the way, Kaya, just for the record, I've been known to go on Twitter even when I'm watching a show.
A phone jail, you put your phone in?
No. But you know what? It's almost a dare sometimes to the show, because there are some shows that I can't do it. And that is one of those shows. And honestly, it's because of Ethan. I mean, Ethan in that fucking show just never makes me want to look away. And it was a fake feeling I had with Anya and Queen's Gambit. See it for the performance alone, but I got to tell you, that's another show on every level. I think they're in sync. They know exactly what they're doing. It's such an incredibly unique, interesting tone and a daring tone for the subject matter. I encourage everyone to watch. I think it's kind of like an unseen gem. I've heard a little bit when it first came out and then kind of dissipated. I hope to God it comes back around and people start to see it, because it's really special.
It's really worth people's time. It's a really strong show anchored by, as you said, it's just an out of this world performance. Going through the remnants of my list, I mean, I love What We Do in the Shadows. I came to it late. I just think I love how silly it is. I love how funny it is. My children, who are not allowed to watch it because it's mostly about cursing and extracting vampire semen, heard us talking about it, and they love it, and they run around the house saying, "Bat, human form, like it's just a great thing to have in my life, and I'm grateful for it. And even though we don't talk about it, it's nice to have a show like that that can just offer so much pleasure and entertainment. And I do want to shout out two things that may have slipped beneath people's radars, although I tried to bring them onto the radars earlier in the year. Betty on HBO is just a love letter to New York and to young women skateboarding. And it is so fun and so loose and such a great high quality hang. And in the early days of the pandemic, it just, as Chris was saying earlier, it just transported me as a young woman skateboarder myself. No, just as someone who misses New York and misses youth. And it was such an easy, wonderful hang, and it got renewed, and I'm excited about that. And quick shout out to Unorthodox on Netflix, which was a fascinating and beautifully told miniseries about a woman who basically escapes from a very oppressive life in the religious Hasidic Jewish Satmar community of Brooklyn and flees to Germany. Incredible performance by Shira Haas. Great job by Anna Winger and her whole team, who also made the Deutschland series. So that's I just burned out my list. What else you guys got that you want to shout out?
I got Pen 15, which was so close, and I kind of like oscillated back and forth. It wasn't on either of your lists, right? No one's list.
No. Great show.
Hilarious. I also, Dave was actually on my list. I don't
Dave,
know. Did it make
Dave
any,
is so fucking funny. Dave is on my
fucking
my long
good.
List.
Oh, but it's not on your top 10?
No.
Did not make, Kaya didn't make your top 10?
No? I've never seen it.
I think it's so good. I don't really LOL a lot when I watch comedies. I'm just that person, you know.
Does LOL stand for layout laundry?
Yeah, exactly. But I'm usually the guy that, you know, smiles when a good joke goes by. But this show, it will fucking make you laugh. I think it's so good. It's also like weirdly a comedy. I gotta put my phone down. I mean, usually with comedies, you can kind of, you know, again, you're not necessarily trying to follow the details. But Dave, it's also got great visual wit. It's not just about the dialogue. The way they compose the shots and play off certain things, it's really, really good and very creative. I mean, some of the sequences that the surreal sequences that they do are great. And then I wanted to bring, I mean, Flight Attendant, Emmy and I are watching right now, is just a fucking blast. And I gotta like give credit to Kaylee Cuoco. I've never seen an episode of The Big Bang Theory, but man, is she fucking tremendous.
She's a really, really good comic actress.
I mean, yeah. Just fucking so fun to watch.
Kai, are you watching that?
Yeah, I'm really, really enjoying it. I've also never seen an episode of Big Bang Theory. Probably never will. And she's just like a total force.
I jammed a couple out on one of my transatlantic flights to London. You know, I've watched a bunch.
Really? I thought you just like took some ketamine and vibed. No,
I just listened to the industry soundtrack and let the chemtrails take me.
Wait, the other thing I wanted to say, because Kaya, you had Cheer on your list, and I know we don't usually do unscripted.
Right. Well, I blame Chris because I asked Chris specifically if I could put something unscripted on my list, and he said yes.
Of course. Okay. Of course it was so, Chris's fault.
Kaya gets producer's preference in this case.
but wait a minute. Let's talk about just real quickly, lightning round on docuseries, The Last Dance, which is another one of those shows that I could not wait for the next episode. There's a great crime docuseries on Showtime that I've not heard anyone talk about, called Outcry. Andy, you probably shouldn't watch it because you have kids. It is a great, great, great docuseries. You're going to get sucked. It's like one of those where you're going to get sucked in. The Vow, which I know it had some maybe.
That was so long. If you want to talk about like.
Totally.
They literally had like MacBook screensavers with like voiceovers.
Sam, did you watch Wilderness of Error?
I did not. Should I write this down?
Yeah, it's on Hulu. It's based on an Errol Morris book, and it's pretty great.
The last shout out, but I'm curious because I know you guys liked it, and I think I had a weird feeling about the show too. The Outsider.
Oh, how that was like my number 11.
It's like 12 or 13. Yeah, it's pretty high up there.
I had no reason for leaving it off. It wasn't any deficiency on its part. We loved watching it. We loved talking about it. We loved the performances. Kind of felt that way about The Great too. You know, I really enjoyed that show. Really liked the performances. It just didn't, neither of them cracked the 10 over the what I had.
Yeah. That's a good year, guys. It's been a
We spent weeks talking about The Boys, a show Chris and I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Just barely missed my list too. Like you were right, Sam, when we first suggested doing it this year, I actually thought it would be not so hard because I knew what I loved and loved more than anything else, but we could have easily done 15 or 20, I think, this year.
The only thing that I feel like we should chat about one more time before we let Sam go, and I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but the three of us loved it. It was Normal People, and that was on all three of our lists.
Well, to me, I loved the performances more than the story, and it was one of those shows where it kind of piled up, and I think I saw two or three, and honestly, the one thing that got me off the train a little bit was they used a needle drop. Yaz's, what the fuck is it
Only
called?
Only You?
Only You, which was used perfectly in The Office, the British Office Christmas special.
You know, weirdly, it was used perfectly in The Americans too, a show loved.
Again, the British Office was prior to any of that. And I think it should retire with The Office, the British Office Christmas special. But yeah, it was one of those where I didn't feel compelled to go back to. And I know lots of people love that show. I did love the performances though. I thought the two of them were great.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing.
That show was just like specifically made for me. Like I really loved the book and I was like really highly anticipating it.
And it lived up to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I think I'm more mad at the plot than like the show didn't do anything wrong. I'm just mad at the plot.
It's just that you just like these crazy kids need to work it out.
Yeah, I just want like a little bit more communication between those two, but it's fine.
What's fun, and maybe this is as good a place as any to end, is just returning to one of the points we started with, which was just not only was it a great year, but it was a really pleasurable year for TV.
Yes.
And whether it was pandemic related or not, like I think Chris and I often judge, and maybe this isn't fair and this is very specific to our experience on the podcast, but we often judge TV on just how much fun we can have when it's on, talking about it, you know, getting feedback, seeing the memes, et cetera, et cetera. And looking even over my list, and there are other examples on your guys' list as well, but like between Mandalorian, Industry, Better Call Saul, Normal People, Queen's Gambit, like, and then even going further into things like The Boys, like these were fun shows to watch. They were really fun shows to cover. And TV it's not the only thing TV does well, but building community like that is one of the things that it does best. And this was a great year for that.
And the one thing I want to just add on to that is I didn't get the glut of prestigious shows that are trying to be serious and win awards. It feels like, especially when they tackle serious subject matters, feels like they just shrugged all that off and said, we're here to entertain, we're here to tell a story, engage people. And that doesn't mean we're going to shortchange the seriousness of what we're exploring. But they didn't sacrifice the entertainment for that. I felt a sense that people were a little looser, a little riskier, a little more, there's a lot more experimentation.
Well, it's not just experimentation. I wonder if it's also expertise. And what I mean by that is like, one of the unsung heroes of TV this year is Ida O'Brien, who is now the world's most famous intimacy coordinator. And she worked on Normal People. Is she on Industry too? I keep seeing her name in British shows. And one of the reasons why that matters is not just for the comfort level of the actors and the filmmakers, but like TV shows are doing sex again. And that's an important part of life and storytelling. And they're building it naturally into the storytelling. Similarly, like you could say, oh, we don't want to touch issues of race or class or sexual assault. But Michaela Cole is saying all of those things are natural to who I am and to my natural storytelling voice. And so I'm going to do them. And so they don't feel made for prestigious entertainment or made for the same shelf you put your Emmy on. They just feel made for the times and made from the heart. And I feel like that is something to just lift up out of this year and sort of champion. And hopefully we'll see a lot more of it going forward.
Yes,
more
totally
sex.
Agree.
More sex. That's what I said.
Should we just list off our top tens just so we have them for audio posterity really quick?
Yeah.
Sure. Let's
Sam,
go
for it. You go first.
10 to 1.
10, Love Life. 9, Queen's Gambit. 8, The Good Lord Bird. 7, Dave. 6, Industry. 5, Mando. 4, I was pointing to you, Chris.
Mando!
Force.
Mando, have you seen Small Axe? There's a tremendous debate about whether it's cinema or television. Who can say?
By the way,
but it's sumptuous evocation of London.
What a pro, uncorking that after 90 minutes.
I just recently discovered there is a Reddit thread called Chris Ryan Heads or so. Do you know about this?
Oh, I've seen
what
this.
What the fuck is going? We got to get out of Twitter.
How did you find this?
Someone tweeted it at me.
Oh God.
Fucking Reddit. Chris, do you go on this and post messages and speak
I appreciate
to your
the support.
Heads?
I can neither confirm nor deny that I've seen that Reddit thread, but I appreciate the support from all of our listeners.
Wow. 2020. What a special year. Has that been around before 2020?
I have no idea, man. It's okay. Really a project I've been working on with my friends at Dominion to get the word out about some of my political beliefs. Anyway, you were saying Mandalorian number six.
Four small acts, as you shouted. Three Fargo, two Devs, and then one I May Destroy You.
Devs pretty high. Andy, what's your top 10?
10, Unorthodox. 9, What We Do in the Shadows. 8, Mando. 7, Industry. 6, 000. 5, Betty. 4, Betty Call Saul. 3, Normal People. 2, The Queen's Gambit. 1, I May Destroy You.
Kaya, you're up.
10, Ozark. 9, Search Party. 8, Industry. 7, Love Life. 6, The Queen's Gambit. 5, Cheer. 4, Betty. 3, Normal People. 2, High Fidelity. 1, I May Destroy You.
I'll wrap us up. I have 10, Ozark, 9, High Fidelity, 8, The Crown, 7, The Mandalorian, 6, Queen's Gambit, 5, Normal People, 4, 000, 3, Industry, 2, I May Destroy You, 1, Better Call Saul. So we have a lot of overlap, a great TV year, a great TV pod. Sam Esmail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
as always.
Guys.
And stay safe, and thank you so much, man.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln in the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid. Featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.